welcome to Short Science, your international era-spanning portal for all the very best science in brief. I'm Elizabeth Hawke, and today I'm joined in the studio by Andy Bailey and Thomas Welsh. Now, the show is going to look at vaccines, from how they work to the issues with the current flu vaccine. We'll be hearing from you at home and having our weekly quiz. This is Short Science. So hello and welcome to the show. Now, Andy and Tom, it's nice to have you in the studio. We've heard from both of you before on the show. So Andy, remind us which show you starred in before.
Hi, yeah, my name's Andy. I starred with Ed Prosser and Katie Draper, and we did a show on the end of the world, particularly focusing on nuclear sort of destruction and disaster. And it was a nice pick-me-up just before Christmas.
It was a fantastic show, and I know it got a very good reception, especially in the States, where it was picked up by a blogger and played out on his own radio show, PQ Ribber. So congratulations on that. It's a really exciting development for us. Now, Tom, you've also graced our airwaves previously, but it was rather longer ago, so remind us about your show.
Hi, Elizabeth. Yes, I was on the show back in October, I think it was, and I did a show with Anna and yourself on handedness. And I also looked at a question from a listener about computer screens and the science behind them.
That's right. Now, James F. sent us that question, how do computer screens work? And I think he was very pleased with the fantastic answer that you gave. Now, let's talk about the show today. What are you guys going to be talking about?
Okay, so I'm going to be talking about the topical issue of the flu vaccine, how they prepare it, how they know in advance what flu viruses to vaccinate for.
And I'm going to be looking at disease immunity models, so things like herd immunity and how many people we need to vaccinate to make sure everyone is safe.
So we're going to be getting down to the nitty-gritty of vaccines and trying to keep it related to the flu vaccine, as that's what's in the press a lot at the moment. Well, let's put the brakes on for a second and have a quick look ahead in the calendar to next week's show. Now, next week we've got a fabulous team taking over the show, Lizzie Crouch, Jan Petrovsky and Katie Draper, and they're going to be talking about language, and I can't wait to hear what they've got planned for the show. Now, don't forget to check out the Short Science website for more details, and that's shortscience.co.uk. Well, before we get too carried away with next week, let's get back to today's show. So it's time now for the Short Science News in Brief. Better breeding for grapes. American scientists have mapped the genomes of many different types of grape. Through the years, certain varieties of grape have been selected for taste to make the best wine, such as Merlot, Chardonnay, Semillon and Riesling. However, these grapes all share a very strong genetic heritage, which makes them more susceptible to pathogens. Introducing more genetic variety into our grapes would make them hardier to disease and would reduce the need for chemical sprays and pesticides. And on to another genetic story now, this time genes determine our friends. US scientists have tentatively announced some possible evidence that our genetic makeup determines who we choose to be friends with. It seems that certain genes, when shared, cause us to become friends, while others, if shared, seem to keep us apart. Now, the scientists used data from two long-running studies that collect genetic data, the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescents and the Framingham Heart Study. Now, it's not certain if the genes themselves are responsible for our friendship choices, or whether they influence our behaviour, which makes us more or less likely to meet certain other people and then become friends. Deepest ocean trench to give up long-held secrets. The Marianas Trench in the Western Pacific Ocean is being probed by scientists who hope it will yield clues about the climate. Now, the canyon drops to 10.9 kilometres below the surface of the ocean, and research suggests that ocean trenches act as carbon sinks and therefore play a large role in regulating the Earth's chemistry and climate. Now, this is the first time that sensitive equipment has been developed that can withstand the harsh conditions and massive pressure that deep under the water. Preliminary results suggest that the results will indeed be very interesting and could yield much-needed information on climate. Smoking deadly in minutes. A study published in Chemical Research in Toxicology suggests that the smoking-associated chemicals which cause cancer develop rapidly after smoking. Although smoking-related diseases tend to occur after prolonged exposure to cigarette smoke, this new finding suggests that the most harmful chemical byproducts of smoking are created within minutes of smoking each and every cigarette, highlighting the importance of quitting as soon as possible. EDSAC rebuild on the cards. The first modern computer is going to be rebuilt at Bletchley Park. The computer called EDSAC, or Electronic Delay Storage Automatic Calculator, was originally built by Sir Maurice Wilkes at Cambridge University in 1949 and fills a rather large room. Now, the Computer Conservation Society is paying for the 3-year rebuild, which will take place at the National Museum of Computing under the watchful eyes of the visiting public. Now, the computer helped to revolutionise complex computation for mathematicians and scientists. GM chickens resist flu. Chickens have been successfully genetically modified to be resistant to bird flu. Now, this could not only help with reducing the spread of flu around the world, but could potentially pave the way for further disease resistance in chickens and other farm animals. Now, this is the first example of viral resistance and potentially could be harnessed to create farm animals that do not carry diseases that enter our food chain and then make us ill. For example, 500,000 people each year become ill from Campylobacter found in undercooked chicken. Now, if the birds were resistant to this bacteria in the first place, our food could get much safer to eat. Well, that concludes the news for today, but let's have a look now at the archive to see what was happening on this day in history. So, on this very day, in 1883, the first electric lighting system using overhead wires developed by Thomas Edison became operational in Rosalie, New Jersey. Another very exciting day for lighting, this very day in 1915, Georges Claude patented the neon discharge tube for use in advertising. And then let's finish the archive news with weather first. Now, the snow seems almost a distant memory here in London, but on this very day in 1977, snow fell for the only time in recorded history in Miami, Florida, and also in the Bahamas. Now, if you have any questions or comments about any of our news, then leave us a message on 07401 856 681. For our international listeners, you just need to omit the first zero and add +44 for the country code for Britain. Alternatively, you can send an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk. Well, let's press on now with this week's Capsule Science. Now, Tom and Andy are going to be telling us about herd immunity.
One of the main methods of vaccinating against contagious diseases is herd immunity. Here the aim is to vaccinate a significant proportion of the population such that those who are not vaccinated or immune still have some level of protection. Herd immunity theory proposes that in contagious diseases that are transmitted from individual to individual, chains of infection are likely to be disrupted when a large proportion of the population are immune against the disease.
So it's the greater the proportion of individuals who are immune, the smaller the probability that a susceptible individual will come into contact with an infectious person.
Yes, that's right. Once a certain number of people are immune or vaccinated and the disease can no longer exist, the herd immunity threshold is said to have passed. The value of the herd immunity threshold depends on a number of factors, such as the virulence of the disease and the effectiveness of the vaccine. Governments have tried to use herd immunity strategies to prevent diseases such as mumps and measles, but efforts have been complicated by people rejecting the vaccines.
So can herd immunity ever fail if the herd immunity threshold isn't passed?
Yeah, sadly, this isn't a foolproof method. Herd immunity can fail if a virus mutates into a new strain of the virus.
What sort of levels of vaccination are needed for herd immunity to work?
Well, I mean, that's a bit of a difficult question. The levels vary a lot. Typically, at least 50% of the population would need to be vaccinated, and even as much as 90% in some diseases.
So presumably the higher the level of vaccination required, the harder it is to make herd immunity effective?
Yeah, that's right. This is one of the reasons why we as humans are not doing better at eradicating diseases. In some countries, it's easier to vaccinate a large proportion of the population than others. Another problem that has prevented herd immunity working at times is people rejecting the option of having a vaccine. This was seen, for example, in the UK when parents refused to let their children have the MMR vaccine for fear that it might lead to their children becoming autistic.
So have there been any success stories, though, for herd immunity?
Yes, herd immunity was successful in eradicating smallpox and has proved effective in reducing polio and diphtheria.
Are there any other approaches that decision makers can use when they're considering a vaccination program apart from just attempting herd immunity?
Yeah, there's loads of others. Many of them are based on the SIR models, as it is a simple epidemiological model that suggests the conditions under which disease will spread. SIR stands for susceptibles, infecteds and recovered. The model states that the rate of change of infecteds equals the rate of change of transmission to susceptibles minus the rate of recovery of infecteds.
So when does spread of a disease occur?
Spread of a disease occurs when a small number of infected individuals infect at least as many individuals again. But if recovery occurs quicker than infection, then the disease will drop out of the population.
Seems like a fairly simple model. Is it very effective?
The SIR model is a highly simplistic model, but it is still effective. One needs to bear in mind that it assumes that there is a closed system with no deaths, although recovered could be treated as dead since they are no longer susceptible or infected.
So is the model actually of any use?
Yeah, it can be used by farmers, for example, to work out whether to vaccinate their cattle against short-lived epidemics that occur outside the breeding system. The model can suggest to farmers what percentage of a population to vaccinate or cull to prevent the disease and its spread.
Okay, so animals, but what can it be applied to humans?
Yes, the SIR model can be applied to humans as well. For example, in diseases such as mumps, measles and rubella.
So what are the key things that we need to know about when we're looking at the SIR model?
Well, in SIR modelling, there is a progression from susceptibles to infected to recovered. It is important to know the transition rate between each component. It is worth noting that there are many other more complicated versions of the SIR model, but they all rely on the same basic principles. For example, there is the MSIR model, which takes into account maternally derived immunity, and the SEIR model, which takes into account people who have been infected but are not infectious themselves. Then there are also lots of age structured models as well.
Well, thanks for that, Tom. There is some really complex work that goes into working out the benefits of vaccination to a big population with different diseases as well. Details of this show and various options for listening again or subscribing to the podcast can be found on our website at shortscience.co.uk. You can post comments there on any of the show pages or on our news pages. So don't hold back. Let us know what you really think of the show. It's time now for our next capsule. Now we're going to hear a bit about the flu vaccine. So Andy, tell us more.
Okay, well, yeah, there's been a lot of tension in the news recently to do with the flu vaccine. So we thought it'd be interesting to have a quick look at why it's important and how they actually go about making it when the flu virus, you know, notoriously changes at a fast pace to outdo our immune systems.
Okay, so let's start off with the flu virus. How is it different to, say, the common cold?
The flu virus is a very different beast. It's a different virus entirely. Than the sort of mildly discomforting common cold, though in the men, obviously, it's a bit more similar.
Yeah.
Unlike the common cold, it can cause sort of deaths, particularly in vulnerable groups like children, people with pre-existing conditions, and pregnant women. So far this year, the H1N1 swine flu, which is this season's dominant strain, has caused a reported 100 deaths. It's brought, brought to the attention of the media and the public the importance of vaccination for these at-risk groups. For saving lives.
So it's vitally important for helping vulnerable people to fight off flu, but why do we need a new vaccination each year?
Well, there's lots of different strains of flu, and each year the new strains are to contend with, and different existing strains become more or less of a risk. So a new vaccine is recommended each year for those at greatest risk for the best calculated protection against flu and its most problematic side effects.
So why is there so much variability in all the different strains of flu that are around?
The flu virus is constantly evolving because it has to survive. It has to be very plastic to be able to evade our memory-like immune systems. But this makes it very hard for just to make one vaccine that would inoculate us against all flus, which you could do, say, for example, which has been done with smallpox and polio. But back in the late 90s, a technique was developed that used analysis of the gene for the antigen, the surface protein, that is constantly changing and enables the flu to deceive our own antibodies. The technique works by exploiting a quirk of the flu virus evolution.
Okay, back up a minute now. So the flu virus is like a little capsule, and stuck on the outside are these proteins called antigens.
That's right, yes. These antigens are different in different strains or types of flu, and they also change over time as the virus evolves.
And it's this outside protein, the antigen, that our immune system can detect and then react to.
Yeah, the antigen triggers our immune response, allowing our immune cells to kill off the any invading viruses, stopping it replicating and stopping the flu illness.
So you mentioned before immune system memory. So when we fought off a particular flu virus with its particular surface antigen, our immune system can remember that antigen and then react to it quicker the next time?
That's the idea, and that is why the flu virus needs to change their antigens and evolve to be able to, you know, to survive. That way the antigen is, you know, different, and it can slip past our immune system, causing us to feel ill, allowing the virus to prosper at our expense.
Okay, so using genetic analysis, we can look at the very mechanism by which the flu virus survives, this antigen.
Yeah, exactly. So like we said before, the flu must constantly evolve to be able to keep reinvading our bodies. If a flu virus doesn't change, it will die out, which is exactly what happens. Each year, all but one virus strain will survive to be the dominant flu virus next year. This produces a family tree that's more stepped than fought, like the majority of biological organisms. So the challenge for scientists is to work out which viruses are most likely to survive and dominate next year so that a vaccine can be made to protect against them.
So tell us a bit more about this genetic technique then.
Well, as you say, it's an analysis of the gene for the surface antigen hemagglutinin. I think I said that right.
Hemagglutinin.
Yeah. Scientists look at like 18 key regions of the gene and the strains that have the highest degree of change from the current year at these regions are the most likely to survive and dominate the following year. This information is then run through statistical models that then end up choosing the two type A strains and the one type B strain that make up the vaccine. The WHO undertakes like a huge sampling program across the globe with its network of national influenza centres, which sample and isolate the flu virus to enable this like massive analysis to be undertaken.
So each year, the flu vaccine that we receive only protects us against a couple of strains. So how certain can the scientists be that they've picked the right strains for the vaccine?
These predictions aren't infallible and essentially are just educated guesses. But scientists are constantly trying to improve the models, and in recent years, developments have allowed them to predict more accurately in just 2 weeks what will be the dominant strain the following season.
So with diseases like flu, there is no such thing as a simple vaccination. A lot of scientific study goes into producing the vaccine each and every year. Now it's the part of the show where we hear from you at home, and we have actually had an email into the studio this week about somebody's personal experience with flu and the flu vaccination. Now this email has come from John F. in Somerset, and he says about swine flu and the flu vaccination. Last year he had both, and they did give him a mild flu-like illness for about 24 hours, although this year he had no side effects at all from his vaccination. He goes on to say that his daughter has a medical condition which makes her more prone to immune conditions. She actually has a sort of immune deficiency. And last year when she had the jabs, she had to go into hospital for 2 days and be put on to antibiotics because of an illness that came with the vaccination. Although this year, everything's gone okay and everyone is feeling well. So it's one of those things, isn't it? A lot of people talk, you know, I work in an office where everyone was asked to be vaccinated, and lots of people said they didn't want the vaccine because they were worried about getting the flu from the vaccine. So have you heard about that, people becoming ill from the vaccination?
Well, I've heard a bit about the flu vaccine. I mean, speaking from personal experience, whenever I've had a meningitis vaccine, I've always been sort of had really heavy flu for the next sort of 48 hours or so. And I've spoken to docs about this, and apparently it might be that I'm personally allergic to the carrier of the vaccine for meningitis. And I can understand exactly what people are like there's never a good time to be ill, but in some ways you've got to maybe sort of try and protect yourself, and sort of taking a day where you're not feeling too well, going to work, it's sort of a stitch in time saves nine type thing. So if you stop yourself having flu for a week, it might be worth the risk.
Absolutely. Angie, have you ever had a flu vaccine or anything?
No, I haven't yet. I've had a few sort of jabs when I've gone abroad and stuff, but so far only a sore arm and, you know, hoping someone don't punch me in it. But apart from that, no, I haven't really had any bad experiences yet.
Yeah, so there are a couple of things about a vaccination that can make you more or less likely to suffer a brief illness when you have the vaccination. Now, the first thing, obviously, is that someone's sticking a needle in your arm. They're making a hole and they're causing local tissue damage and putting a quantity of fluid into a space that there was no fluid before, which is going to cause local bruising. So everybody is going to get a slightly sore arm after a vaccination, some people more than others maybe. As you said, Tom, people can have allergies to either the medium that's used to grow the material in the vaccine. So for example, with the flu vaccination, these are grown in fertilized chicken eggs. So they grow actual live flu virus. They then kill the virus and use that to make the vaccine. So anybody that has an allergy to egg should be particularly careful with the flu vaccination. I think they only recommend avoiding it if you have a severe egg allergy. But, you know, it's one of those things that maybe you don't necessarily know that you have an allergy. I mean, eggs, it's an obvious thing. People know they are or they aren't. But other chemicals and medium that are used maybe in the labs, people wouldn't know that they're allergic to, potentially. And then there's the issue of people actually contracting the disease they're supposed to be being vaccinated against. So you can have a reaction, you can have an illness, high temperature, maybe flu-like symptoms, which could just be an activation of your immune system to the vaccine without you actually having contracted the original illness. But I have heard of cases where people have developed the full-blown illness that they were being vaccinated against. Now, this is more common with other types of vaccine where a live version of the actual organism is injected. And there have been some particularly distressing cases with the polio vaccine, which is why most vaccines are made from killed or attenuated organic material. So the actual bacteria or the virus isn't injected live into you, which obviously sounds very risky and scary. So that could be the reason why some people have these reactions. And then also people who have any kind of impaired immune system or any condition that makes their immune system react differently to any kind of insult might have a bigger or a different reaction to a vaccination. So why is the flu vaccine important? Well, every single year we have an epidemic of influenza which emerges during the flu season. Now, around the world there are two flu seasons, one in the northern hemisphere and one in the southern hemisphere, so both occurring in the cold periods of the year. And worldwide, seasonal influenza kills an estimated 250,000 to 500,000 people. And that's without there being a pandemic or anything. That's just the normal every year sort of rate of flu. Now, the first ever influenza pandemic was recorded in 1580. And since this time, people have been trying really hard to eradicate the cause of these pandemics. So let's look at some of the pandemics that have occurred through the years. Now, in 1889 to 90 was the Asiatic or Russian flu. And the mortality rate was said to have been nearly 1 in 1,000 people. Now, that's a lot of people dying.
It's quite scary. I mean, particularly even the Spanish flu of 1918, I was reading the other day, they reckon is the biggest pandemic ever to hit, you know, human population, even more so than the Black Death.
Absolutely.
In the Middle Ages.
So Spanish flu was 1918 to 1920, and 500 million people were affected by the flu, with 20 to 40 million dying. And that was actually a very similar strain to our swine flu. It was H1N1. And then more recently, in 1957, there was an Asian flu that killed 1.5 million, and that was H2N2. 1968 to 69, there was the Hong Kong flu, which killed nearly 1 million people of H3N2 flu. And then in 2009, our swine flu pandemic, much hyped in the press, which killed 14,286 people, which kind of pales into insignificance.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm very sorry for all those people that died, but it wasn't 40 million like we had with the Spanish flu. So as we've said, nowadays the vaccine is created by growing the virus in chicken eggs. And this actually started in 1931 when a guy called Ernest William Goodpasture and his colleagues at the Vanderbilt University developed this technique. And they were able to then produce large quantities of the influenza virus and experiment with making vaccines. And in fact, in the 1940s, the US military developed the first approved inactivated vaccine, so a vaccine that's made of a killed virus for the flu. And it was used throughout the Second World War. And obviously now, with the advances in science, technology, vaccinology, immunology, vaccines are much safer than they were in those days, and they're produced on massive scales to allow vaccination of the whole population. So guys, who do we think are the people in the population most at risk who need to have the vaccination?
Well, in the press recently, there's been a lot of hype about pregnant women because there's been a shortage of the vaccine, and you know that apparently barely like 10% or so of the pregnant population have been inoculated.
And then, of course, there's people who've had transplants, etc., and so on immunosuppressants and things.
Absolutely. So we've got people who are immunosuppressed either through having an illness like HIV or through taking medications because they've had a transplant. Anybody with a chronic disease, so that could be liver, kidneys, heart, lungs, should really have a vaccination because their immune system is constantly dealing with their disease status. And so it's a bit tied up to be worrying about things like flu. And so therefore, if they do get something like that, they're more likely to have a poorer response, fight off the flu less well, and then get the secondary complications, which are the things that kill you, like pneumonia or generalized infection throughout your body called sepsis. Now, as you say, there have been some high profile cases where pregnant women have died. There was a lady that died a couple of days after giving birth, just after Christmas. And it has caused a lot of distress in the population. And I think people have been very confused. They've been going to their GPs to find out, am I eligible for a vaccination? And some GPs have been vaccinating the recommended population. Some GPs have been vaccinating anybody. And some GPs have not had any vaccine to give, and so have been vaccinating nobody. And I think even though the recommendations seem to be quite clear that it's the elderly, chronic diseases, pregnant women, people with immunosuppression that should be being vaccinated, it doesn't seem to be a sort of national global policy. It seems to be if you live in this postcode too, you're all right.
There we go. And it seems to be sort of a GP's autonomy of sort of, there isn't a, like you say, they haven't rolled out a national framework to say, you know, this is how it's going to be. And some people seem to be missing out, which is
I think it's not really clear whether it's GPs making decisions for themselves, maybe based on inaccurate or old information, or whether it's simply the fact that GPs don't have the vaccine to give to people. And nobody seems to be really clear about what sort of side the problem is falling on, whether it's a GP thing making decisions on people's behalf, so whether it's a kind of a central problem with the government not making clear enough guidelines, or whether it's just simply a distribution problem with vaccine not going to areas of the country where it's needed. But anyhow, so if you have any stories about the flu vaccine or any questions, don't forget to get in touch. You can record a message for us on our recording service at 07401 856 681. We can play that out on the show next week, or you can email in any messages or material to studio@shortscience.co.uk. Well, it's time now for our quiz. So, gentlemen, do you have your quiz questions at the ready?
Yes.
Right, let's get cracking.
Okay, so this is about the polio vaccine, the first question. Is the injectable polio vaccine safer than the oral polio vaccine?
Okay. You would guess oral, because there's nothing being penetrated into your body, you're not breaking any tissue.
Well, I think it's the difference between one of them is the live attenuated vaccine and one is the dead vaccine.
Right.
And the live attenuated vaccine, obviously, there is this small risk. And I personally know somebody that had this vaccination. I don't know whether it was the oral or the injection, but they had the vaccination and they actually contracted polio and are very disabled now as a result of that.
Wow.
So it does happen even today. I would have thought the oral one is the safer one, as that's the one that's given to most people.
But I remember having that one. It tasted horrible and we got free sweet.
Used to get it in my day, we used to get it on a sugar cube.
Oh, really? Oh, I just got it back
the worst tasting sugar ever.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so oral, I reckon.
Yeah, go on. So what's the right answer?
The right answer is actually injectable, because the oral polio vaccine is a live virus and there's a small chance, I reckon, 1 in 2.4 million people get the virus from it.
Wow. Yeah. That's quite scary.
So you should opt for the needle next time.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, question two.
Okay, so how many diseases are there currently which we can vaccinate against that are commercially available?
Quite a lot.
Yeah, there must be loads. Counting on the fingers.
I've got to 6 on the normal childhood vaccinations, and then there's a couple of meningitis ones, so that's 8. Then you've got all of your travel vaccinations. Mm. There's probably about 10 of them, so 18.
And then there must be a few that...
19 yeah. cervical cancer jab.
Yeah.
Flu, 20. Yeah, I'm going to go for about 20. There's probably loads more.
There must be. Maybe I'll go for 30 then, just to mix it up.
Well, Andy's actually surprisingly close. He's on 27, so the answer is 27, so he's only 3 out.
Yeah, not
but
bad.
I don't think he didn't account for all of his. I mean, I accounted for all of mine.
Maybe that's where you're going wrong. Maybe.
Yeah.
I got a question for you, actually. When was the flu vaccine first when was it first separated out of and crystallized into a single form? When were they first able to identify it as a virus?
The actual virus,
yeah,
not
what
the vaccine.
Year? What year? Yeah, what year were they? Did they first sort of identify it as a virus and separate it?
What do you reckon, Tom?
I have no idea, but I've just got a sneaky feeling it might be 1947 because I've got to pick a date sometime.
Okay. I think it's earlier than that because they made the. They grew it for the first time in chicken eggs in 1931.
That's right.
So they must have known what they were growing before that. So I'm going to go for 20s.
Well, it's later. It's afterwards. It's in 1933. It was at the Mill Hill Laboratory here in North London. Apparently they were able to do it because they were working on ferrets, working out to try and make a vaccine for cats and dogs I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but one of the technicians gave the flu to the ferrets, and because they were already working on sort of that sort of strain of thing, they were able to isolate it, and yeah, that was the first time they realised it was definitely a virus.
So these American guys growing it in chicken eggs had really no idea what they were doing.
Apparently so.
Just inject this stuff into this chicken egg and see what happens. Fascinating. Okay, next question.
So the next question I've got is... when was it believed? Is it believed that the first early forms of vaccination were developed, and in what country?
Ooh. Well, the first vaccination that was developed was smallpox, and that was done by Edward Jenner, who noticed that people who were infected with cowpox didn't get smallpox. So then he purposely went around infecting people with cowpox to immunise them against smallpox, and he famously did it on a little boy that he found in the street, first of all, gave him the cowpox, and then gave him smallpox.
Right.
And obviously he didn't get the smallpox because he already had an immune response to the cowpox. And then there was a whole thing with, I think it might have been Queen Victoria, but I might be wrong about that. It was some religious royal family, and they were travelling, and they were in... like Hong Kong or China or somewhere, and they were routinely using this vaccination method there. And I think it was Queen Victoria or a queen or a king, and had their family vaccinated, and that was what really brought it to public attention. This was a good idea and a good thing to do. That's all I know about vaccinations. Thank you very much.
So it must be smallpox then. Assumedly British?
Yeah, and then it must be late 1800s or early 1900s.
Yeah. Late 1800s, I reckon. 1890?
Okay, well, I think you're both sort of along the right lines. I mean, yes, Edward Jenner was the first one with smallpox from cows.
Cowpox,
sorry.
Immunising against smallpox, but using cowpox.
Using cowpox, and that was in Britain. But there is actually evidence of vaccination going back as far as 200 BC in China from archaeological remains, although what it was... and how it was done, they're not quite sure, but it seems to be something they found with ancient humans, but ancient sort of our ancestors. They found sort of evidence in the rocks of maybe sort of using leaves and animal sort of bits and pieces to try and vaccinate back then.
Okay, well, thank you very much for listening. This is indeed all we have time for. This has been Short Science. The presenters today were Thomas Welsh and Andy Bailey, and myself, Elizabeth Hawke. The production was done by our own good selves, and the theme tune was written and produced by Don Gould of Music by Design. Thank you very much to John F. from Somerset for sending in his contribution. So thanks very much for listening, and we'll be back at the same time next week for another episode of Short Science.